Chapter 10. Finding Clotilda. After concealing the slaves on the various plantations and successfully conspiring with Judge Jones to avoid prosecution for his crime, Timothy Mayer spent the next 30 years enjoying the fame his association with the Clotilda had brought. He was frequently interviewed by newspapers and magazines from around the country, which treated the Clotilda story as a swashbuckling adventure. He had become enough of a celebrity in his lifetime that the New York Times published an obituary upon his death, declaring him the importer of the last cargo of slaves brought to the United States. But even after the Civil War, Mayer worried that federal officials, or the former slaves, would try to press charges against him for illegal slaving or kidnapping, respectively, if they were to locate the wreck. The fact that federal officials had been unable to find the ship when Mayer was arrested days after the Clotilda arrived had been critical to his escape from prosecution. He was especially worried after his incarceration and prosecution for blockade running made him well known to federal officials in the post-war years. I believe Mayer intentionally used his numerous media interviews to throw people off the trail of the wreck. In 1890, during one of his last interviews, Mayer revealed that he retired as a steamboat captain when he was legally compelled to allow African Americans to rent cabins on board, rather than force them to ride below with livestock and other cargo. He also gave an account of the Clotilda's last voyage in the interview, and said the ship was sunk in a place called Bayou Connor. Other sources quoting Mayer, including numerous historical documents and the half-dozen books about the Clotilda and Africatown written between the late 1800s and today, variously placed the wreck in Bayou Connor, Bayou Corn, Bayou Cano, the Mobile River, and the Spanish River. These places all exist, but they are not where I found the ship. By suggesting the wreck was in Bayou Connor or these other locations, Mayer sent searchers miles north of where the ship had actually been burned and scuttled. The ruse worked. For 160 years, the fate of the Clotilda remained a mystery. The first efforts to find it began almost as soon as the ship was destroyed. Officers of the U.S. District Court in Mobile spent 5 months searching unsuccessfully for the ship and the Africans in 1860. During the next 60 years, people came to routinely and incorrectly identify several wrecks in local waters as Clotilda, often pointing to various design features supposedly shared with the ship. Some of the mistaken identifications happened simply because several old shipwrecks around Mobile Bay were quite prominent into the early part of the 20th century, with parts of the ships visible above the water's surface even from a great distance. Compounding matters was Mobile's 400-year history as a seaport. More than 280 shipwrecks have been located in Mobile Bay and the swamp immediately to the north. Most remain unidentified. Some of them are ships that sank as early as the 1600s. Others are ships or barges that were intentionally sunk after they'd become too worn out to sail. Wooden ships, like the Clotilda, had a fairly short working life of about 25 years. Built before the revolution in construction techniques brought on by the mass production of screws, nuts, and bolts in the 1870s and 80s, the wooden sailing vessels of the Clotilda era were held together with nothing but giant nails. Decades at sea, with the constant stress of rising and falling waves, gradually loosened them, making the ships leakier and leakier, until eventually they were no longer seaworthy. As a result, several bayous around Mobile Bay are well-known ship graveyards, where old vessels were beached or sunk to get them out of the way of the shipping channels and rivers. Based on precise descriptions of the Clotilda's design filed in the Federal Archives in Atlanta after the ship was built and registered, we know none of the wrecks positively identified by the experts of the day in ship graveyards and other places could have been Clotilda. That did not stop sightseers from paying a few dollars to hire boats to take them to the supposed scene of the crime to see one of the imposter ships. Even the city of Mobile got into the act in the 1950s, removing pieces from one of these incorrectly identified ships and putting them on display as relics from the Clotilda. There were numerous efforts to locate the Clotilda in the 1980s and 90s, some by amateur sleuths and some by people and companies specializing in finding sunken ships. Often, companies hired to map obstructions in the main river channels under federal or state contracts would keep an eye out for 19th century sailing vessels in the hope of stumbling upon the infamous ship. After novelist Clive Cussler made international news with his successful 1995 effort to locate the wreck of the Civil War-era Hunley, the first submarine to sink an enemy ship in combat, he said that his next search would be for the Clotilda. Coincidentally, both the Hunley and the Clotilda were built in Mobile. Oddly, the Alabama Historical Commission refused to allow Cussler permission to search for the ship, despite the fact that his team had located dozens of historic wrecks. Cussler's rejection was due to another Clotilda search then underway. That effort was led by Jack Friend, a noted historian and eccentric from Mobile who authored the definitive history of the Battle of Mobile Bay, where Admiral Farragut is said to have yelled, "Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead." Friend had allies on the State Historical Commission who rejected Cussler's permit application in order to give native son Friend a chance to find the ship. Despite countless hours of research and thousands of dollars spent hiring a maritime survey company in the early 2000s to explore a portion of the vast Mobile Tensaw Delta, Friend came up empty. Given the hundreds of unidentified shipwrecks around Mobile, and the fact that the Delta encompasses hundreds of thousands of acres, this was not surprising. The Delta is a gigantic swamp, about 13 miles wide and 50 miles long. It is one of the largest continuous wetland complexes in the United States. Dozens of rivers and creeks twist and snake through its ghostly stands of Spanish moss-draped cypress and broad meadows of cattails and marsh grasses. There are a lot of places to hide something as big as a ship in the Delta. Precisely why Mayer and his conspirators chose the seclusion of the swamp for the end of their journey. I have made a career out of studying and exploring the Delta, with more than 20 years spent traveling the nooks and crannies of the vast wilderness. I produced a documentary and a book, Saving America's Amazon, about the system, along with hundreds of newspaper articles. I also earn part of my living running nature tours in the Delta, taking people deep into its remote interior aboard my boat. Over the years, I've encountered a number of shipwrecks, usually nothing more than the ribs and keel still visible, but I'd never considered looking for the Clotilda. In part, that is because I wasn't familiar with Africatown's origin story as the place where the last slaves brought to America settled after slavery, and didn't understand that the ship that brought them here was missing. That changed when my friend Jeff Dute, a manager at the Bass Pro Shops sporting goods store near my house, called and suggested I look for the ship in 2017. Jeff gave me an abbreviated version of the story and said he'd just heard John Sledge, a City of Mobile historian, on the radio, saying the fate of the ship was one of the nation's great unsolved mysteries. Hunting for the wreck of a schooner sunk before the Civil War sounded so outlandish, like looking for pirate treasure. And I told Jeff so. But after we hung up, I typed Clotilda into Google and started to imagine the places in the Delta one might hide something as large as a schooner. If the ship was truly hidden somewhere in the swamp, I figured I had a better chance than most people of finding it. My initial research, digging into Sylviane Diouf's book and then a trove of historical documents at the Mobile Library, showed that the lives of the captives who arrived aboard the Clotilda had been well documented. Yet the mystery of the ship's fate lingered. During the 30 years he lived after the Clotilda's arrival, Mayer had left his trail of misleading breadcrumbs for would-be ship hunters. But as I read over them, many of his claims fell apart, just based on my knowledge of the swamp. The Clotilda was 26 feet wide and needed 4 feet of water to float. Both measurements meant the ship was simply too big to traverse much of the giant swamp's interior including some of the places Mayer mentioned specifically by name. But to visiting journalists, the bayou names Mayer spouted off were as exotic as the wilds of Dahomey. Only a small handful of people in Mayer's day, or indeed even today, despite the presence of Google Earth and GPS, would know where some of these locations are. Additionally, then as now, the Delta's many sloughs and channels have multiple names, depending on which of the several towns around its edges you come from. One of the most persistent Clotilda hunters was the Mobile-based historian, Jack Friend. He spent his time and money chasing down the story Mayer told in one of his last major interviews in 1890, which had been treated as the definitive account of the Clotilda's fate by nearly everyone who wrote about the ship. Upon Friend's death in 2010, his papers were donated to the History Museum in Mobile. I spent an afternoon in late 2017 going over Friend's Clotilda research with John Sledge, a city historian and writer who wrote The Mobile River, an authoritative history of the city's seaport. He shared Friend's interest in the Clotilda, and the two had been close friends. Buried in one of the boxes of Friend's papers was a formal report compiled by the survey company he hired for his Clotilda search. The survey started at the mouth of Bayou Canot and headed north, encompassing the places once known as Bayou Corn and Bayou Connor. The crew used side-scan sonar, a magnetometer, and a sub-bottom profiler. Together, the three techniques paint a picture of the riverbed and any objects sitting on it, detect any metal items such as anchors or ship fittings like nails, and probe a dozen feet below the muddy bottom, looking for things that might be buried under river sediment. Friend's search turned up nothing in any of the locations suggested in the books and documents. My own research had already suggested a different location, farther south, next to 12 Mile Island in the Mobile River, a few miles north of both Timothy Mayer's plantation and shipyard. Going over the primary historical sources, a significant discrepancy caught my eye. In his interviews, Mayer had claimed the slaves were offloaded from the Clotilda to his steamboat in the Spanish River, and then the Clotilda was towed to Bayou Connor, or another spot, and scuttled. This sequence of events had been repeated in numerous articles, and in several books about the Clotilda in the last 100 years. It had been repeated so often it had come to be accepted as fact by generations of historians. But as someone who frequents these locations regularly, I knew that the Spanish River and Bayou Connor are miles apart, with lots of lonesome and secluded swamp in between. Why would you unload the slaves in one spot, then spend another hour towing the slave ship north before burning it? It just didn't make sense. Multiple witnesses, including Captain Foster, the Mayer brothers, and their trusted slave James Dennison, all agreed that the Clotilda had been towed into the swamp through the Spanish River in order to bypass the port of Mobile, which sits on the Mobile River. But the Spanish River is particularly narrow, with bars so shallow they can ground even a rowboat, never mind a steamboat or ocean-going sailing vessel. An old riverboat captain like Mayer could have accomplished the treacherous trip towing the Clotilda through the Spanish in the dark, but I can't imagine that there would have been room enough anywhere in the river for the Clotilda and a steamboat large enough to carry 110 slaves to pull up alongside each other for the transfer of the captives. The river is only 2 miles long, and the channel as it runs today is not big enough for such a transfer between boats that would have been more than 60 feet wide if lashed together side by side. Plus, the Spanish River runs into the Mobile River within sight of the downtown port, which our band of criminals was trying to avoid at all costs. It seemed the last place one would pick to make a discreet transfer of more than 100 chained captives. Better to keep heading north, toward the plantation where the slaves were to be stashed, and make the transfer in a more secluded spot. After we examined Friend's papers, I told Sledge my theory that the ship was along the backside of 12 Mile Island. What's more, I told him I thought Friend and the authors and researchers who had repeated Mayer's description of where the ship was burned had been duped. My theory was based partly on something I had noted in a journal account by Captain William Foster, who actually sailed the Clotilda to Africa. The account had been available to Friend and the historians who wrote about the ship, but for some reason all of them seemed to discount its description of where the Clotilda was destroyed in favor of Mayer's seemingly more detailed version in the 1890 interview. I learned of the existence of the captain's journal from a member of the Mayer family, who has chosen to keep his identity secret. He told me that he first saw the journal when a local dance teacher who is a descendant of Foster's offered to sell him the captain's possessions from the ship, including the desk, chair, and clock from his cabin. Mayer declined to buy the items, then was offered two journals handwritten by Captain Foster. One, Mayer said, was so faded as to be almost illegible. I believe this was the ship's log Foster kept on board during the actual voyage. The other was the handwritten and slightly embellished version of the ship's log that Foster wrote years later. The member of the Mayer family who told me about the journal got the dance teacher to agree to donate the later version of the journal to the Mobile Library, though not the furniture and clock. I have since confirmed that Foster's descendants still have other Clotilda-related items, including the original journal Foster kept during the voyage. I have appealed to them to donate any artifacts they have for the new Africatown Museum or to the Smithsonian, but the relatives have cut off all contact since I made the suggestion. Perhaps they will read these words and be inspired. Foster wrote his account in 1890, 30 years after he sailed Clotilda to Africa, and it is clear it was an attempt to claim some of the fame Mayer had been enjoying. It is titled The Last Slaver, and mentions Timothy Mayer only once, with Foster describing the captives Mayer paid for as my slaves. It clearly burned Foster to see Mayer celebrated as having brought the last cargo of slaves to the country, when the steamboat captain had actually remained safely behind in Mobile, while Foster faced four mutinies among his crew, a hurricane, and several narrow escapes from the anti-slaving fleet during the voyage. The 12-page journal contains a tantalizing tidbit regarding the destruction of the ship. Foster recorded the scene this way. At 12 Mile Island, I transferred my slaves to a river steamboat and sent them up into the canebrake to hide them until further disposal. I then burned my schooner to the water's edge and sunk her. Now this made sense. 12 Mile Island would be a perfect place to both burn a ship and swap illegally imported slaves from one vessel to another. Much more remote and discreet than the Spanish River. The northern tip of 12 Mile Island is 12 miles from the port of Mobile, hence the name, meaning it is about 7 miles farther from downtown Mobile than the Spanish. Plus, the water around 12 Mile Island is plenty wide for two ships to tie up side by side. While the west side of 12 Mile Island was and still is the main river channel, the east side of the island is desolate and never visited by commercial traffic. What's more, Cujo told Zora Neale Hurston the ship was burned at 12 Mile Island. Now, when the actual burning happened, Cujo would have had no idea where he was and would never have heard of 12 Mile Island. But when he was enslaved, he spent the next 5 years working on Mayer's steamboats. At 87, during his interviews with Hurston, he was able to call out the names of 21 river landings along the Mobile River, where 12 Mile Island is located, in perfect order. It seems certain he would have learned the location where the ship was set on fire during that time, along with the name of the island, especially because fellow captives like James Dennison participated in the towing and destruction of the Clotilda. Furthermore, a newspaper article from 1917 relied on a Cogo Lewis as its primary source. It is almost certainly Cujo who tells the reporter that the Clotilda was afterwards towed up to 12 Mile Island and burned to the waterline. As I dug in on my research, I discovered that the Mayers had owned the land around the east side of the island since the 1850s. What better place to transfer a cargo of illegal slaves and burn and sink a ship than alongside a chunk of remote swampland you own? I had a location. All that remained was to find a ship. For that, I planned to make use of the lowest tides of the year, which typically occur in January. On the second day of 2018, I headed up the river toward 12 Mile Island. I actually launched my boat at Mare State Park, which is named for one of the brothers, who drove one of the steamboats as they moved the Africans and the ship into the Delta. Thanks to the bomb cyclone of 2018, then ravaging the Northeast, a stout north wind had blown much of the water out of Mobile Bay. Tides in the Delta were about 3 feet lower than normal. After a 20-minute run in 30-degree weather, I was at 12 Mile. Almost immediately, I found the bones of a ship. At normal water level, the vessel would have been completely underwater, but on this day, it was largely uncovered. I took aerial photos with my drone and close-ups of the construction techniques and types of wood. I later took Winthrop Turner, a shipwright expert in 19th-century ship construction, to the site. He identified the vessel as a schooner built between 1840 and 1875. That fit, as Clotilda was christened in 1856. His descriptions and my photos were enough to intrigue a pair of marine archaeologists in nearby Pensacola. The University of West Florida's John Bratton and Greg Cook were part of a team that discovered and explored a dozen Spanish galleons from the 1500s sunk in Pensacola Bay. They knew their stuff. Within a few days, they were on my boat headed to the ship. Their team made careful measurements, took lots of photos, and concluded that we had a ship that was definitely built in the 1850s or 1860s and appeared to be precisely the same width as Clotilda. We were unable to get a reliable length for the wreck, as it disappeared into the mud, but the team estimated it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 feet. That was pretty close to the Clotilda's known length of 90 feet. I spent 3 weeks studying the wreck further and assembling everything known about the ship. On January 23, 2018, I published a story with the headline, "Wreck found by reporter may be last American slave ship," archaeologists say. The story went viral on an international scale. I was hailed as the man who finally found the Clotilda, the last slave ship. 2 months later, it was announced that an international team was coming to Mobile to investigate the wreck. The team included the Slave Wrecks Project, the Smithsonian Institution, the National Park Service, Divers with a Purpose, the Alabama Historical Commission, and a marine archaeology company called Search, Inc. The leader of the investigation was Search's Jim Delgado, a celebrated marine archaeologist who had led one of the last expeditions to the Titanic. I spent a lot of time that first day talking with Dr. Delgado, who was most interested in hearing how I had homed in on this particular stretch of the Mobile River. We talked of the discrepancies in the historical record, the realities of geography regarding the locations mentioned, about Jack Friend's survey, and Foster's journal account. After about 3 hours, he pointed toward a pair of divers trying to find the end of the ship. Using long metal poles, they were able to probe through the mud and find the outline. "You see, the divers are measuring it, with John at this end of the tape," Delgado said, pointing to a man holding a large measuring tape on a reel a few feet from us. "Right now, they are at 157 feet, 4 inches. "That's a big boat," I said. "It's too big." "Well, it is too big, so..." Jim stared at me for a minute, his mouth puckered in, like someone holding bad news they don't want to tell you. It was the first inkling that I had likely made a massive journalistic error. "I don't want you to take this too hard. This is how you look for ships. It's not easy. I mean, you came out here and found a ship of the right design from the right era in the right place. That's pretty impressive. And look at the attention you've brought to this story and the area. It's international. I don't want you to feel badly or be embarrassed. You've done something incredible, even if this is not it. I think you have figured out where it is. I think Clotilda will be found right around here." I remain grateful to Jim for trying to let me down easy. He spent about 45 minutes at the stern of my boat, both of us in dry suits, him trying to keep my spirits afloat as I faced what was certain to be a public humiliation. I think he knew I was going to take it hard, and I did. It was a long night when I got home, I'll say that. And much whiskey was drunk. I knew exactly how far the story had spread, how many people on both sides of the Atlantic were excited. In the 2 months since the first story, I'd even taken the ambassador of Benin to see it. As a reporter, I prided myself on seldom ever having a correction, despite doing complex, in-depth, investigative reporting. Now, on the biggest story I'd ever broken, a story that had spread worldwide, my central premise was wrong. My father, Howell Raines, a career journalist and Pulitzer Prize winner, tried to soften the blow. You published a piece full of caveats. You quoted archaeologists, you took experts to the site. You used the word may in the first sentence and everywhere else. You're totally covered from a journalism perspective. Perhaps I was, sort of, from a journalism perspective. But in the court of public opinion, in our soundbite world, my soundbite was that I'd found the last slave ship. The next morning, a little bleary from the night before, I showed up in Africa Town for the press conference, where they planned to reveal to the public that it was not the right ship. The list of all the reasons this could not be the Clotilda was excruciating to hear in detail, for it highlighted how badly my ship had missed the mark. Several descendants refused to believe the archaeologists, insisting the scientists were wrong, that the ship had to be Clotilda, and the state was trying to hide the truth on behalf of the Mayer family. I could see the disappointment all around me. 2 months before, I had been invited to speak to several hundred Africa Town residents crammed into the same room, the morning after my first story. At that meeting, residents talked excitedly about putting the wreck on display in a new museum in Africa Town and what the discovery would mean for the moribund town and its forgotten history. During the next 2 months, as I interviewed dozens of people in Africa Town, I came to understand what made the story resonate with the descendants and the entire world. The enslavement of millions of people spread over 400 years was largely an anonymous crime, in that we know nothing about the victims or the perpetrators beyond rough tallies of how many people were sold in various ports. No record of who they were or where they came from. But the Clotilda is different. Thanks to family lore and the books and articles written over the last 150 years, we know many things about its African passengers, including who captured and sold them, how their lives turned out, and where their descendants are today. The Clotilda story resonates because it is the origin story of the African diaspora globally. We know of the lifelong sense of loss the survivors felt, of the rich cultures they came from, the horrific fates that befell their African families left behind. The possibility of the ship's discovery had animated the community, setting off a flurry of meetings and celebrations. The news from Delgado had the opposite effect, delivering a crushing blow to morale. People were crying as the presentation concluded. One of the descendants, Thelma Mabin Owens, who runs the community garden in Africa Town, had followed my work closely, and I'd noticed her watching me during the meeting. I'm sure my emotions and personal disappointment were easy to read on my face. After the presentation ended, she wrapped me in a hug and quietly sang the words of a gospel song in my ear. There's a bright side somewhere. Don't give up and don't give in. As she let me go, she looked me in the eye and said, "Don't you stop until you find it, Ben." Later, as I left the meeting, two guys who worked for a company called Fathom Undersea Research and Engineering introduced themselves to me. I recognized the company they worked for as it had recently located a Belgian ship from the 1700s off the Alabama coast. They told me that a decade prior they had tried to look for the Clotilda while they were being paid to search the Mobile River for two Civil War ironclad warships. They said their survey carried them up the river close to the bottom of 12 Mile Island. They told me they figured, as I had, that Mayer had always lied about where the ship was. Even before my conversation with them was over, I knew exactly what I was going to do. These guys had done a high-tech survey of the river below 12 Mile. Jack Friend had searched the river beginning right above 12 Mile. But no one had ever searched 12 Mile Island itself. which is precisely where the captain of the ship said he burned it. I would immediately conduct the first ever modern survey of the 12-mile island section of the Mobile River. I just needed to come up with about $10,000 to pay for a survey boat. 10 grand was a daunting amount of money for a newspaper reporter, but Thelma's advice rang in my head. The next morning, I called Dr. Monty Graham, the head of marine sciences at the University of Southern Mississippi. Monty is an old friend, and he'd been following my reporting on the ship. I asked if he would bring a Southern Miss crew to Alabama to do a full-scale bathymetric survey of the Mobile River around the east side of 12 Mile Island. He asked if I had a budget. Such surveys involve a boat equipped with hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of survey machines connected to multiple laptop computers, which collect reams of data from the survey equipment in real time. Survey boats so equipped are commonly used in the oil industry. I told him I didn't have any money, but Monty didn't hesitate. I'd love to do something to help Africa Town, and it'll be good for our grad students. How about next week? The University of Southern Mississippi's hydrographic science team showed up. It was led by Max Van Norden, Dr. Anand Hiroji, Marvin Story, Candace Gunning, Ashley Boyce, Jennifer Rhodes, and Alex Hersberger. By the end of their search, Monty's crew had located 11 possible targets in the 2-mile stretch of river. With so many big objects so close together, it seemed clear we were looking at a ship graveyard, which explained the presence of the first wrong ship I'd found. This still fit with Foster and Cujo's recollection of where the ship was burned. After all, what better place to dispose of a ship than the back of a secluded island where several ships had already been sunk? It took a full week for the team to collate all the data and produce a three-dimensional picture of the river bottom. We began examining various underwater possibilities using coordinates from the 3D picture. We immediately ruled out several of the targets before we even returned to the river, because they were simply too large to be Clotilda. But we settled on one in particular because it was about 90 feet long, precisely the length of the Clotilda. On the side scan sonar imagery the team produced, you could see a wooden deck with missing planks and several open hatches. The bow and stern stood out perfectly. It looked promising. So promising I could hardly sleep. All I could think about was putting on my scuba gear. I lay in bed, imagining myself dropping down on the wreck to explore it and coming up with the bell from the ship with the name Clotilda stamped on it. Ship's bells are considered one of the best ways to confirm the identity of 19th century shipwrecks. A week later, just 2 weeks after all the visiting archaeologists had left Mobile with no plans to return, Monty was on board my boat with the owner of the underwater works dive shop and my mechanic, Joe Turner, who would captain the boat while we were in the water. It was early April, and the spring floods were on. The current was running hard, and the river was so muddy it looked like chocolate milk. As soon as we began exploring the most promising wreck, the one I'd been lying awake imagining, we knew it couldn't be Clotilda. The deck was the only thing on the entire ship made of wood. The hull itself was made of iron, indicating a ship from the Edwardian era, right around 1900, not an antebellum era wooden schooner like Clotilda. It looked like we were done. The best candidate from the Southern Miss survey was a bust. We agreed to head back to the dock. As everyone packed up their dive gear for the run back, I called up the survey chart on my phone. I guess I was hoping to see something everyone had missed. A bathymetric survey looks sort of like a topographical map, except instead of lines getting closer together or farther apart to indicate changes in altitude, different colors are used to show changes in water depth. For our chart, most of the river was pictured in yellow, indicating a fairly uniform depth of about 15 feet. But along the edges near the bank, the shallower depths were pictured in orange, and the shallowest areas in red. Scattered around on the river bottom out in the channel, there were a number of what surveyors called anomalies. These were spots where water depth suddenly changed, due to an object lying on the bottom. The anomalies showed up on the survey chart in slightly different colors, either red or orange, depending how high an object rose up off the bottom. Many of the anomalies were clearly trees or natural debris on the bottom. Monty's team had spent a week homing in on the anomalies they thought could possibly be Clotilda and marking them on the survey. Peering over my shoulder, Chaz Broughton from the dive shop pointed at a slightly discolored area that had not been highlighted. "What's that?" he said. I remarked that it looked like a shoe. "Not to me, that looks like a ship. Let's check it out." Monty called the lab from the boat and described the spot to his tech. She found it on the map and texted us the GPS coordinates. It was about 300 yards north of the first ship I'd found. The tech said it appeared to be about 90 feet long. My heart started beating faster. We anchored the boat over the spot and I jumped overboard. Nobody else was willing to get back into the cold water at the end of a long day, so I got in alone. I could feel logs and other debris on the bottom. I started diving down and picking the logs and branches up, moving them out of the way. Monty and crew on the boat were laughing, saying I had discovered a pile of sticks. I kept pulling up logs. Then I felt something bend beneath my foot as I put my weight on it. My first thought was that it might be a piece of wrought iron, a sign that whatever was on the river bottom was made in the 1850s, like the Clotilda. Keeping my foot firmly pressed against the bent piece so I wouldn't lose it in the heavy current, I started sliding my hands down my leg toward my foot. I had to do that because the river was in flood stage, the water a turgid brown. It was impossible to see anything, even with a mask on, through the muddy water. Diving blind, I used my leg as a guide, running hands down thigh and calf, then over my dive boot until I grasped the metal under my foot. I could feel that it was hammered through a thick plank of wood with squared-off edges, clearly a piece of hewn lumber, not a log. I tugged lightly on the plank, unsure if it was just stuck in the mud or part of the larger structure I was exploring. After a moment, the old nails holding it fast gave way, and it came free in my hand. I popped back up on the surface and held the piece aloft. It was about 5 feet long, with several large rusty nails poking out of it. They were square cut and clearly handmade by a blacksmith. I called to my friends on the boat, "Guys, we just found something from the 1850s. Monty and Chaz got in, and within minutes we knew we had found a ship that appeared to be the same length as the Clotilda. Nearby on the bank, I spied a concrete survey marker that had been newly painted bright red. Already an extremely odd sight on the riverbank in the remote swamp. In big block letters, the marker bore the name Mare, a reminder that the family still owned this stretch of shoreline as it had since the 1850s. A few days later, I called the Alabama Historical Commission to report that we had located the remains of another ship from the 1850s, and that it appeared to be about 90 feet long. After a stunned silence, I offered to provide them the coordinates to the ship, as well as our full bathymetric survey. They got Delgado on the phone, and everyone began asking me questions about the find. I told them it was the only object we'd encountered that could possibly be the Clotilda. It would take an international team of archaeologists a year to confirm the find, but that moment when I pulled up the piece of wood with the nails poking through it, was the first time the Clotilda had seen the light of day in 160 years. Chapter 11. Finding a Future in the Past. The people of Africa Town struggled to grapple with the attention and energy surrounding the announcement of the Clotilda's discovery. The media came in full force and from around the globe. There was excitement in the community, but also a fear of not having anything to show for all the buzz. Lorna Woods, whose great-grandparents were founders of the town, laid bare the challenge facing Africa Town days after the ship's discovery was announced. "Everybody's looking at us, but we don't even have a store where you can buy goods on your travels through Africa Town. It's nothing to see and nothing to do," Woods said. Many people have come to Mobile and said, but what about Africatown? You have it on the map, but what are we going to see? What are we going to do once we get to Africatown? Nothing is to show here in Africatown that would bring the history out. We don't have it to show. I would love for it to be shown that this was the last place a slave ship arrived. We don't have a museum or a building or anything, just a sign on the side of the highway. In addition to all the reporters, four separate documentary crews were filming at the community's big celebration. Everywhere you looked, cameras and microphones were pointed at residents. I made myself useful by carrying news crews from around the world up the river to the desolate swamp where the ship had been found. I took reporters to the site 2 or 3 days a week for months after the discovery was made public. Every time I launched the boat, I made sure we left from Mare State Park as a personal poke in the eye for old Captain Tim and his scoundrel brothers, who'd helped the night the ship was burned. I also often bring along descendants or community leaders on these trips, so more of them can see the remote spot where their ancestors began their American lives. A lot of them find themselves crying as we drift over the wreck. A Kenya-born sound man for CBS who made the trip said, "Man, when I heard we were going to Alabama to film a partially burned slave ship, I said we should burn the rest of the thing until there's nothing left. But now that I've been there, I don't feel that way anymore. It was powerful being there. I think seeing the actual ship, whatever's left, burnt and rotten in a museum, would be powerful too." Long before the ship was found, a core group in Africatown worked to promote the Clotilda history, going back decades. For some, the goal was simply to honor their ancestors and the story of their struggle. Others wanted to use that history as a way to draw people in, to resurrect Africatown, to restore the prosperity and vitality they remembered from childhood. Cleon Jones, the baseball hero, became a one-man Habitat for Humanity with his Last Out Society, organizing volunteers to paint houses, mow lawns, and try to restore the community's curb appeal. Then there was the Clotilda Descendants Association, the Benin Alabama Trade Forum, the Chess Foundation, the Mobile County Training School Alumni Association, the Africatown Community Development Corporation, and several other groups pushing separate agendas, sometimes at cross purposes. All those groups in a town of just 2,000 people. They focused variously on successfully getting Africatown listed on the National Register of Historic Places, restoring the town's housing stock to attract new residents, creating business connections to Africa, fighting the expansion of heavy industry, working to clean up legacy pollution, restoring the town's access to the river, and trying to keep county officials from closing Africatown's aging school. Over the years, bitter feuds have sometimes developed between many of the leaders of the groups. In particular, there was conflict between people who still lived in Africatown and people who had long since moved away but remained active within the community groups. When the ship was found, friction between the rival groups threatened to thwart progress on any front. In the months that followed, on multiple occasions, the leaders of one or another of the different groups sent out mass emails demonizing leaders of other groups by name over disagreements about the best path forward. An unfortunate truth quickly emerged in the glare of the media spotlight, especially after anthropologists from the Smithsonian Institution arrived to collect oral histories. What they found was that the story of the Clotilda lives on in official records and documents and in the books about the ship, but not in most of the people living in Africatown today. Descendants are scattered across the country, and many are only recently learning the story of their Clotilda ancestors. Unlike the Gullah Geechee culture in coastal South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida, where descendants have kept ancestral stories, art, crafts, recipes, and an African-based Creole language alive, there is little hint of an African language spoken in Africatown, not in words used by residents, the names of streets, or anything else. The Gullah descendants, who were geographically isolated on barrier islands and remained socially isolated as those islands became playgrounds for wealthy beachgoers, have managed to turn their cultural provenance into a tourist draw. with museums, a heritage trail, and a healthy schedule of public events. Many of the people living in or tied to Africatown want to create something similar. But much of the history has been lost, or hidden, or dynamited. During the archaeological investigation, it was revealed that the chunk of the ship I first found was a few feet away from the main hull, which was partially buried in mud. It appeared the ship had been blasted with dynamite at some point in its underwater history, which knocked the upper sections off the main frame, leaving most of the hold where the captives were kept intact. Because over the course of a century, the river had filled the hull with mud, shielding it from the blast. Jim Delgado told me this detail months before the find was finally confirmed, but the moment he said dynamite, I knew it was the Clotilda. Joe Mayer, the oldest of Timothy Mayer's great-grandsons and a well-known racist, had been telling a story about dynamite around town for decades. Mayer, who died in March of 2020, told historian John Sledge, author of The Mobile River, that he and his father dynamited the Clotilda in the 1950s or 60s. The goal, according to Mayer, was to make sure nobody could ever find the Clotilda and help the descendants launch a lawsuit or kidnapping claim against the family's large Civil War-era fortune. This meant, of course, that Joe and his father knew where the Clotilda was all along, for the last century and a half. I think other people in their orbit knew where the ship was as well. I say this because the day I published my story about the first ship, the one that was too big to be Clotilda, a man who grew up with the Mayers called and told me I'd found the wrong ship. When I asked him how he knew, he said, "I just know, that's not the Clotilda. You're getting people all stirred up over nothing with all this. You should just let sleeping dogs lie." Then, when I found the second ship, a year before it was even confirmed, he confronted me in the grocery store and told me I was ruining Joe Mayer's retirement. When I asked if it was the Clotilda, he said, "You're getting them stirred up over nothing." Ultimately, Joe Mayer's dynamite boasts provided one of the forensic clues archaeologists relied on to positively identify Clotilda. Another blow to the community's effort to reconstruct its story came in the form of Hurricane Katrina, which destroyed the closest thing Africatown had to a museum. It was a homemade affair, a welcome center set up in a mobile home across the street from the first church and the cemetery. It was destroyed by the hurricane in 2005 and never replaced. The site is now overgrown with weeds, supervised by two headless busts sitting atop a brick wall. One set of shoulders cemented to the wall belonged to a bust of Cujo Lewis, the other to a former mayor of Pritchard, John Smith, who championed the restoration of a connection between Africatown and Benin beginning in the 1980s. He set up a formal twinning ceremony, making sister cities out of Africatown and Ouida in Benin, the city where Foster bought the Clotilda captives. The ceremony was held in 1986 during the Africatown Folk Festival, which attracted a slew of prominent activists, including Reverend Jesse Jackson, Congressman John Lewis, comedian Dick Gregory, and author Alex Haley. It also drew a delegation from Benin, including the Archbishop of Cotonou, Isidore de Souza, a direct descendant of Francisco de Souza, the most infamous slave trader in world history. John Smith continued his activism as a private citizen in the early 2000s, establishing cultural festivals in Africatown and Ouida featuring artists from both countries. He was interviewed backstage by a television news crew in Benin in 2004 at Festival International Gospel and Racines. In grainy footage posted on YouTube, an interviewer asks, "What is Africatown? Is it a specific place?" Smith tells the Clotilda story, explaining, "It is a specific place where the people who came from Ouida lived. Their families are there. Their families, their churches, their cemeteries." Dressed in traditional African garb, he describes how he believes African Americans feel about Africa and themselves. They have strange and weird feelings, and often negative feelings, stupid feelings about Africa. They have stupid and awful feelings about themselves, their mothers and fathers. It will require a process of education on the part of us, who know better, to get them past these awful thoughts about themselves and about their identity. In 2006, Smith managed to get a bill on the ballot in Alabama designed to create a free trade zone for African goods on the edge of Africatown. A 1,000-acre parcel along the river was donated toward the effort to house what Smith envisioned as the Sub-Saharan Africa and Caribbean Trade Center, which would feature buildings designed to look like African-style huts, food vendors, and an open-air marketplace for duty-free African goods imported through the state docks. If the bill passed, Africatown would become the central entry point for African goods, from fruits and vegetables to clothing and raw materials for industry, delivered by container ship. Smith was ecstatic preparing for his vision, 25 years in the making, to become a reality. He died of a heart attack on election night when he learned the ballot measure had failed. His remains are interred in a museum in Ouidah. The Sub-Saharan Africa and Caribbean Trade Center dream died with him. But part of his vision, a museum celebrating the Clotilda and her passengers, appears to be coming to fruition. Before the ship was even discovered, Africatown's activist groups applied for and won a $3.8 million grant from Alabama's share of the BP oil spill settlement money to build a new welcome center on the hill above the cemetery, to replace the destroyed mobile home. Then, in the wake of the ship's discovery, another federal grant was given to create a heritage center in the community, which will be the initial facility designed to hold any relics found in the hold of the ship. But neither the Welcome Center nor the Heritage Center will be anything close to the scale and power of the new Legacy Museum and National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama. To anyone who has seen the line of people snaking around the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture years after it opened, or seen the packed parking lot at Montgomery's new museum dedicated to victims of lynching, the plans for Africatown seem far too small for the sort of exhibit the Clotilda story deserves. Vicky Howell, a former journalist with the Birmingham News and president of MOVE, Making Opportunities Viable for Everyone, agrees. Howell was a key part of the team that created Birmingham's excellent Civil Rights Heritage Trail, and actually wrote the text on the dozens of signs scattered around the city's historic sites. When I looked at where they were talking about putting the Welcome Center, I said it wasn't big enough. But when I was told there was not going to be a museum, I said, well, that's not going to do. For me, we had to have a place that was big enough to be the kind of place where people not only spend money, but can spend time and learn the history, Howell said. Surveying Africatown's geography, she realized the long-abandoned Josephine Allen Housing Project site, which encompasses 42 acres of rolling hills, was a perfect spot for a nationally relevant museum. Her team launched a national design competition inviting urban planners and architects to reimagine Africatown, filling its vacant lots with new homes and replacing the decaying and abandoned housing project with a cultural center on a grand scale. Darren Patterson credits Vicky with thinking big and sticking to her guns when people in the community scoffed at what she imagined. He said the old guard, himself included, was thinking at first about what they could scrape together, not what the history deserved. One design for the old housing project site would include a shopping district and a replica of the Clotilda floating on a lake, where passengers would be able to enter the hold of the ship where the captives were kept. The museum will be designed to house the actual wreck if it is ever dug up out of the mud. However, the fate of the ship itself has now become a separate point of controversy, with descendants demanding the state of Alabama, which owns the wreck due to state and federal laws governing historic objects found in state waters, begin to excavate it. Immediately after the find was confirmed, the Alabama Historical Commission suggested that instead of digging up the ship, perhaps it should be left in place, miles from civilization, deep in the Mobile Tensaw Delta, an alligator-infested swamp that is 13 miles wide and 50 miles long. This suggestion for a Pearl Harbor-inspired memorial that could only be accessed by boat met bitter resistance in Africatown, with residents accusing the state of attempting to hide the most important piece of proof regarding what happened to their ancestors. The battle continues today, more than 2 years after I found the ship, with the state still refusing to commit to pulling the Clotilda from the mud, mostly due to an expected cost in the tens of millions of dollars. So far, Alabama has pledged $1 million. Not digging up the ship, that's just stupid. The ship is the history. When I went to Memphis and I saw the Lorraine Motel where Martin Luther King was killed, I cried. That's the same history we've got here in Africatown. People are going to cry when they see the ship, said Lamar Howard, whose food truck feeds everyone at all the community celebrations. The people here, we ain't fixing to get no reparations. There's no 40 acres and a mule. There's not even a gas station. But if you've got an idea, then you can come be a part of this. Help build the community. I'm going to open a store. I don't care if it is in a tent. I want to have something where people can come and go home with something to show they've been here. I don't care if it's t-shirts or earrings or books. I want them to be able to show they've been to Africatown. They say there is going to be a trail from Atlanta to Montgomery. Then when they do this museum here, that trail is going to come all the way here to where it all started. But we don't have anything if we don't have the ship. You know that saying, the truth will set you free? Well, the ship is the truth. All the black folks in America got here chained up on ships just like that. The elation and international attention that greeted the discovery prove the ship has already become a cultural touchstone. The Clotilda is an internationally important artifact. It is the only ship ever found that brought enslaved Africans to America. There is a piece of a slave ship about the size of a brick on display in the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of African American History and Culture, but it is from a South African ship that sank in port in Brazil and has nothing to do with the American slave trade. Having the burnt, rotten hull of the last American slave ship on display would instantly make Africatown one of the most important sites in the burgeoning civil rights tourism industry. Museums in Benin have already asked to have small pieces of the ship to display in that country. To the community, having the wreck on display in a new museum is vital to both resurrecting Africatown's declining fortunes and reconnecting the people living there to their own history. But even with the coming museum and facilities, the struggle to collect that history continues. There is a constant refrain among many Africatown residents, whether they are in their 70s or their 40s, that they grew up not wanting people to think they were connected to the Africans. That stigma is at the root of much of the suppression of Africatown's history, sometimes by the descendants themselves. Darren Patterson, the Descendants Association president and great-great-grandson of founder Poley Allen, finally learned he was a descendant by chance in 2010 during a visit to Africatown. His family moved to Texas when he was 17, and Patterson spent most of his working life in Detroit, removed from his Africatown roots and relatives. During his visit to his hometown, he encountered two women on the street who had been friends of his mother's. He was stunned when they told him he was a descendant and should join the Descendants Association. For the first time, at age 60, he understood that his great-aunt Mama Eva was actually the child of one of the Africans. Had he known before her death in 1992, he could have asked her directly about her parents and the rest of the captives. But that opportunity had been stolen from him by his mother because she was ashamed of the connection. Eva Allen Jones, Mama Eva to generations of Africatown residents, was born in 1894, the year after Mary McNeil Scott visited Africatown with Noah Hart and saw the settlers in their small remote cabins. Eva lived until 1992. She witnessed the rise of Africatown to the heights of the 1950s through the 1970s, and then the beginning of the decline. Her African father was 51 when she was born, married to a second wife, an American-born woman, after the death of his first African-born wife. Cujo and many of the Clotilda survivors gathered regularly at Eva's house when she was young, speaking in their native tongue. In her later years, she and Lorna Wood's grandmother were two of the last people left in Africatown who knew some of the original settlers and could tell stories about what they were like and what they said about their homeland. But neither woman ever learned to speak Yoruba, Fon, or any African languages from their parents. Even during her childhood around the turn of the century, Eva said being connected to her African father and roots was cause for humiliation. "We didn't want kids laughing at us," she said, explaining why she never used the African name, Joko, that her father and his Clotilda survivor friends called her. Beyond the language issue, even Eva's recollections, captured in an interview taped in 1978, are fraught with memories that don't comport with established facts. For instance, Eva told her interviewer that her father and his people spoke Zulu and were from the Congo. The Zulu are the most prominent ethnic group in South Africa, more than 2,500 miles south of Benin, while the Democratic Republic of Congo is 1,500 miles away from Benin, and no one there speaks Zulu. Those words, Zulu and Congo, were popular in American culture to describe something African during Eva's lifetime, but they have nothing to do with the people who arrived on the Clotilda. "It is not their fault, but so much has been lost," said Sylviane Diouf, author of Dreams of Africa in Alabama. "We have the story because we have the books by Emma Roche and Zora Hurston, not because it was passed down." When researching her book in the early 2000s, Diouf said she tracked down some descendants living in the New York area. They knew of the Clotilda story and that it belonged to their ancestors. "But the things they were telling me, these were things I recognized from an article from the 1950s. They were claiming their particular ancestors hadn't actually been enslaved. They had escaped into the swamp and lived there until after slavery. This didn't happen." Even coming from a family that was proud of the heritage wasn't enough to ensure the history was preserved. Gary Lumbers is Cujo Lewis's great-great-grandson and grew up in Cujo's house. He lived there with his grandmother, known as Sweeta, who was Cujo's granddaughter and helped care for him in his old age. Cujo taught Sweeta his African healing skills, relying on plants and other natural compounds, and into the 1960s when Gary was a boy, people would still line up outside the house for his grandmother's traditional remedies. Gary's mother, Mary, was one of the young girls leaning against Cujo's knee in one of the only surviving pictures of him. She was one of the children he grew his sugarcane for. Despite these close connections, Gary says most of what he knows about his family's story comes from the books written about them, rather than from his relatives. "I heard so many things about the ship. I heard that the ship was somewhere down there and caught on fire and they jumped off the ship shackled, things like that. Or some of them didn't end up slaves. It was so many myths. To actually know the whole truth, the real truth we know now with the books, it's different," he says. Cleon Jones, who made the game-winning catch in the World Series as a member of the 1969 New York Mets, says he too realized the myths he grew up with in Africatown needed to make way for the truth. "We found out as black folks that history was a lie. We learned we can write or rewrite our own history." Of late, Africatown has been holding a lot of gatherings under the big bridge by the river to celebrate and honor the ancestors and the discovery of the ship. The bridge looms over the spot where the slaves camped rough in the first weeks after they were freed and left the plantations where they had been imprisoned. A plan is in the works to turn it into a park, honoring the Clotilda story.